Welcome to Hard Truths, everybody. Gen Squeeze podcast about Canada's broken intergenerational system, how we can fix it. My name's Paul Kershaw. I'm the founder of Generation Squeeze, and I'm here today with two talented friends and Gen Squeeze volunteers, Kareem Kudus and Molly Harris. We're gathering to talk about a new report that we have just released together. It's called Celebrating Stalling Prices for Canadian Homes. Why Canadians Need Statistics Canada to Improve Measurement of Housing Inflation in the Consumer Price Index. With a title like that, I know we're going to reach the best-selling list just by tomorrow. It's going to be a page-turner everyone's going to want to read. The hard truth that we're going to focus on and that's featured in this report is that, yes, home prices have stalled in recent months in Canada. And as they have stalled, though, they've done so at very harmful levels. There remains a really unhealthy gap between average home prices and earnings in most places in this country. And alas, our country's inaccurate measurement of housing inflation is implicated in the massive gap that remains. A gap that means that the typical young Canadian needs to put in 27 years of full-time work to save a 20% down payment in an average-priced home in Metro Vancouver or the GTA, 22 years on average in BC and Ontario, 17 years on average from coast to coast. Whereas when my mom started out in the housing system just four decades ago, it took 5 years on average. So such a big deterioration in the way that hard work pays off for younger Canadians today, and that as we come to terms with that and come to terms with the fact, yes, home prices are stalling, we can't think that, oh, you know, housing and affordability solved, they're not going up any longer. No, they've stalled at a really harmful place. So I want to dig into that theme with Molly and Kareem Moore, these talented folks who've helped us at Gen Squeeze write our most recent report, and I want to welcome you both to the podcast. Thanks for being here today.
Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for having us.
So to both of you, I'll go in order, Molly first, then Kareem. I'd love if you could begin by highlighting for us one or two key findings from the report that stood out for you.
Yeah, absolutely. Something I really appreciated in the report, and it's maybe taking a few steps back to think about when we talk about housing affordability, oftentimes the conversation centers on rising cost of home ownership. And I think it's necessary to take a broader approach to housing affordability, which this report definitely makes an effort to do. So when we're talking about affordability, we're not just thinking about the rising cost of home ownership, but we're also thinking about how rising costs impact renters and other people who are maybe not even in the market housing kind of game. And then it's also important to think about how rising costs impact different groups differently, and how this is especially important in the context of systemic racism and decades, if not centuries, of structural barriers to home ownership. So when we talk about housing and affordability, we're just considering the disparate impacts. And maybe I'll leave it there and we can pick up on that more.
Yeah, those are all big themes that I'm confident will continue to rise in our dialogue. What about you, Kareem? What's standing out?
Yeah, for me, it's kind of what you already described, Paul. We all know housing prices have risen over the last few decades, but I thought it was really amazing to see the visualizations we have in there of how much they've really risen. To see the fact that in the 70s, it took 5 years for an average person to save for a down payment, and now it's gotten up to 15, 20, 25 years in certain places. It's really shocking to see that. And we also describe in the report how inflation, as you mentioned, the mismeasurement ties into that. And this trend has been relentless, especially over the last few years. And it's been interesting over the last few months or since the beginning of the year, as interest rates have started rising, we see that that trend has stopped or kind of reversed. So it's become obvious now how much of a factor interest rates have to play and demand. So much of our dialogue revolves around supply in this country of building more houses, but now we're really starting to see how much of a role demand has to play.
Well, let's dig into that a little bit more, and I want to bring it back so we're putting the two key observations you and Molly shared into dialogue. But coming back to you, Kareem, you know, what do you take away from the fact that as interest rates rose, you know, that started to make the cheap credit system slightly more expensive to access, that has clearly had a downward impact on home prices? what if we'd only made those changes earlier to interest rates, and why didn't we do that?
Yeah, it's kind of painful to think about it, because if we had done this, you know, and the average price was just starting to rise at this incredible rate that we've seen, we could have stopped things there before they got to the point where we are now, which is going to be a much more painful process of rising interest rates now when there's so much debt that's been accumulated. And the reason why this didn't happen is because of Statistics Canada. Their mismeasurement of inflation, or in particular, how they haven't properly accounted for rising home prices in our inflation index, or CPI.
So make that concrete for me. I mean, we've actually had you on the podcast in the past, and we'll put in the notes of the episode we were chatting about the challenges with measuring inflation at StatsCan. But what is StatsCan not measuring that matters to somebody like you and Molly trying to think about making your way in our dysfunctional housing system?
Yeah, and I think this should matter for everyone, not just people like us who are trying to get into the housing system. But what they're not accounting for is the cost of acquiring a home, the cost of buying a home. So CPI, our inflation measure, tries to account for shelter generally, so they have things like rent in there. But the only way that homes are accounted for is the cost of upkeeping a home or of owning a home. So it measures the cost of owning a home for homeowners, but nowhere is the cost of getting into the market of buying a home accounted for.
So you're telling us actually, as StatsCan is going and trying to report for everyone in the country about how valuable our money is relative to our cost of living, that they don't actually pay very much attention at all to, like, how much would one have to save in order to put a down payment on a home, or how much would one need to borrow after they made the down payment to cover the rest of the cost?
Yeah, it's shocking, right? But as we describe in the report, home prices were up something like 21% over the course of 2021. While the shelter component of CPI was only up something like 6%. So it's just completely disconnected, our inflation measure, from the actual value of money. And lots of people are losing a lot of their purchasing power, and we're just not accounting for that in our inflation measure, and as a consequence of that, in our policy decisions.
Well, let's pick up that purchasing power theme then, and want to turn it back to Molly, because, you know, it is disproportionately younger Canadians who are losing their purchasing power, or newcomers of any age, and for that matter, renters who are older. And Molly, you were saying that one thing that you like about the way this report has come together is that we focus a lot on the average cost of housing, but we understand what that has been meaning for those who are not owners, and the implications for those who may never even begin to pursue ownership as an option. And then thinking about how that plays out along racialized and classist and sexist lines and what have you. So help us understand, why does the rising cost of average home prices in cities across this country end up having a harmful impact on those who are not owners?
Mm-hmm. Well, as the cost of homes go up, there's greater competition for those homes, probably continuing to push those prices up. That means that there's, as prices rise, more and more people are excluded from owning a home. People who maybe, as you mentioned, 4 decades ago, your mom was able to get into the market, but maybe someone in a similar position now, they're not able to purchase a home. So they're staying in the rental market. And then that in turn drives up competition for the existing rental stock that we have in Canada. And it kind of varies depending on where you are in Canada. I'm on the West Coast. The rental stock we have is largely older, or it's in the secondary rental market system. So it's a homeowner renting out their basement suite. And that's not necessarily a secure form of housing for a lot of people. So even for someone who's content being a renter, maybe doesn't aspire to be a homeowner, they're still facing the impacts of that rising competition and rising prices in home ownership.
When we think about the added precarity that's faced by renters who occupy multiple spaces along the income gradient. I mean, we can be talking about some lawyers making six figures in some of our bigger towns who are, you know, struggling to find a 2-bedroom place to, you know, have enough rooms for the second kid they want to have. You can think people in more in the middle of the income gradient, and as they're competing for the available housing that was often, you know, more reserved for the working poor, then we push the working poor into what was social housing, and then social housing is less available for those who are street homeless, and you can just see how we exacerbate the entire continuum of unaffordability. One thing about this report that I like is that it reminds us that this crisis of unaffordability is tolerated because rising home prices have not been uniformly bad, at least not for everybody. And I like to, you know, in this report and other places, I'll use my own story that, you know, in the year that Kareem was saying in 2021, when home prices went up on average in this country 21%, BC Assessment told me that I gained $500,000 of wealth while I slept. Which meant that people like you two, Molly and Kareem, who are just as smart as me, just as hardworking as me, but happen to be slightly younger than I am, starting out in the housing system later than I did, don't have the same opportunity to live where I do, whether as owners or renters. And so I wonder, as we publish this report, in no small part, because I think we're at like this critical moment in the dialogue about housing. Like, for the first time in a while, we've seen home prices stall, even moderately dip. And we're in a competition, in my view, for the hearts and minds of Canadians. What do we think about this? What do we want from housing prices going forward? Is it good that home prices have stalled or dipped? And I think that's such an important part of our report. And the whole reason we gave the title, Celebrating Stalling Home Prices in Canada, because so many of the cultural instincts we have that are featured in our media day in and day out is that, well, the housing market's hot when home prices are rising. Oh, it's a soft housing market when sales have slowed and stalled housing prices. It's not a healthy housing market any longer if home prices aren't rising. And that clearly signals like a cultural tendency to like, oh, housing is to make owners wealthy, as opposed to reserve housing as places to call home for everyone. So I want to ask you directly, I think it's critical that we celebrate stalling home prices, especially for young people, newcomers of any age, and you're kind of that demographic. So what do you make of our conclusion that it's important to celebrate stalling home prices?
Yeah, absolutely. I am all on board with celebrating stalling or falling home prices. My excitement over that conclusion comes from my personal stance that housing is a service and a social good. And as you said, it's a right. It's everyone deserves housing that works for them. And that means that stands in conflict with the belief or assumption that a home is our retirement savings. Like those two can't coexist in my mind.
Yeah, I think you're completely right that it can't serve as both a retirement fund and a home for everyone. And I think it's just because it's not a sustainable retirement plan. Maybe one generation can benefit from that. But then what are we going to do? Have it double again in the next generation? And at some point we get to where we are today, where an average cost house is costing 100% or 200% every month of the average income. And there's nowhere to go now. It can't act as a retirement fund for the next generation. It's just not sustainable.
And
I really think that's... Oh, go ahead, Molly.
I was just going to add, picking up on the point Kareem's making and on the unfairness of using housing as a retirement savings plan, because as I mentioned before, there's not equal access to home ownership for all Canadians. Some racialized Canadians are disproportionately kind of lower represented in home ownership. And so then when housing becomes it is one of the main forms of intergenerational wealth transfers, we're then thinking about large swaths of Canadians who are just excluded from that wealth transfer. And so 70% of Canadians overall own homes, but that's only 45% of Black Canadians and 50% of Indigenous people in Canada own homes. So it's just thinking about those inequities embedded in relying on the housing market as a broader kind of personal safety net.
Yeah, well, I'd like to develop that a little bit more, because we know from a broad range of economic evidence that the primary driver of inequality from a financial standpoint is the returns to capital, returns to your existing wealth. And the most common kind of wealth that Canadians have has historically been housing. And you've just described, Molly, how a range of racialized dynamics, and we could definitely add a gender lens to that, will mitigate against some having the same kind of access to that wealth that I do as a white boy. In addition to that, though, we have been sheltering housing wealth from taxation in a way we shelter no other assets. And we're like, if you can get your hands on this housing wealth, then government says, we're going to signal that we do think it should be a good investment return for you. We're going to protect that from any taxation after the fact, which has been such a particular bounty for people in like the Greater Toronto Area, Hamilton, Vancouver, Victoria. You know, I often think about an older retiree in Fredericton who might have bought her home like when my mom did four decades ago. And, you know, they bought the home in today's dollars, about $250,000. And in Fredericton, the house is probably now worth like $315,000. She's on a modest income, say $40,000, you know, definitely nothing superbly affluent with that income. And she looks over at her counterpart in Vancouver or Toronto, and they bought their home at the exact same price. They have the same $40,000 income. But now they live in homes that are $4 or $5 million in value. And our tax system treats those two retirees, the one in Fredericton, the one in Toronto, or I guess make it three, and also the one in Vancouver, identically, really, all things considered. But their relative economic security there is fundamentally different. And so we have to be able to account for that when we're thinking about how we ask people to contribute to the services that we need, whether it's healthcare, education, and so on. And I really think you said something so important, Molly, when you observed that we can't hope that housing is going to be our retirement plan. This has really become normalized in many parts of British Columbia and Ontario. And I think our report, which shows exactly what's happened to earnings since the mid-1970s, relative to exactly what's happened to home prices, shows why Kareem said it can work for one generation. In this case, it actually worked pretty well for baby boomers. But they'll now sit around a Thanksgiving table or whatever holiday table comes up next, and they'll see their kids and their grandchildren increasingly shut out of housing security. And the entire reason that they're shut out is because on our watch over the last many decades, a group of people were content to have housing be a place to call home. It started that way, and then a nice way to get often rich. It worked for one time, but it can't happen again, because all it will do is, one, further grow the gap between home prices and earnings, and it's frighteningly large now, which will then further hurt people who walk in our footsteps. So I think that with this report, it's a call to all ages, young and old alike, to say, now we need to be the change we want to see. Like, we have to just change what we're looking for from housing. And sure, you might, if you're lucky enough, get into home ownership with a big mortgage, and you slowly, over 25 or 30 years, pay off that mortgage. You know, it's kind of like paying into a piggy bank. That's fundamentally different, though, than hoping that the value of your home is going to double or triple over the same period of time. And the latter, I think, has been just particularly harmful to talented folks like you.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think a nice way to summarize this is to say that we as Canadians look at homes as investments, not as places to live. And we really need to change that view of homes. We need to stop thinking about a strong housing market as something good. We need to see that as something that's pretty unhealthy. And if it's good for my parents, it's bad for me. So we need to all look at it more broadly, I think, than just ourselves.
Don't you think, though, that maybe we just need to redefine what we mean by a strong housing market? Wouldn't a strong housing market, if our goal is affordability, one that is stalled for the next many years, maybe dips moderately, as we've been seeing, so that, you know, earnings can catch up, wouldn't that be a strong or a healthy housing market? Isn't that what we're needing to, like, redefine?
I agree. Yeah. And honestly, I agree that we need to celebrate this stalling of prices, like you asked earlier. Because it's a pretty big deal, right? We've seen them rising for so long, so relentlessly. But I'm not sure if stalling is going to be enough realistically to get us to a point where housing is affordable. I think right now, for the average person in Canada to afford a home, even if they stall at these prices for the next 20 years, income needs to double. Is that realistically something we can hope for? It seems unlikely to me. So we still have a long way to go, even despite where we're at right now.
And that's why the language of, stall or moderately fall, and then we leave a little bit vague. What do we mean by moderately fall? Because, you know, a whole range of political anxiety will start to evolve in response to that. And to some degree, now we're into conversation about tactics. You know, what are the tactics to create enough political cover for our politicians to be courageous and say, yes, we want to grow our economies in ways that don't see average home values continue to rise, where we celebrate the stall, maybe celebrate the moderate fall. Like, how do we do that for politicians? And maybe I'll use that as a segue to something I wanted to ask you. I mean, we use this report that we're publishing, celebrating stalling home prices in Canada, in really tactical ways. And, you know, Molly, you've just completed your master's degree at Berkeley. Kareem, you're doing your PhD at U of T. You know, you're really familiar with, you know, peer-reviewed literatures, and our report isn't that. I mean, Jen Squeeze does lots of stuff where we're publishing in academic journals and establishing the evidentiary base for our analysis of Canada's dysfunctional generational system. This report, though, is not really the kind of thing that would be of most interest to, you know, scholars who dig in heavily into the ins and outs of our housing system. I mean, we've organized it for a different purpose, where we can just describe for Canadians in in every province and in many cities in each of these provinces, like, what's been happening in your housing system and how has it unfolded for people at different starting points in their lives? What's been your experience of trying to create this kind of tool, and why do you think it's important for curating public dialogue in Canada?
Yeah, I think the knowledge translation that Generation Squeeze is working to do is such important work. As you said, I just finished my master's at Berkeley and was surrounded by some of the most brilliant, in my mind, housing justice scholars that I've ever come across, and kind of through my own work, felt really smug about this research I was developing, looking at the financialization of rental housing and bringing in Marxist theory and using all these big words, and then finishing the research and realizing, like, so what? Where does it go? Does it just sit on a shelf? So I think finding ways of relating what's happening in the academy to the everyday experiences of people just trying to live their lives, trying to get by for themselves and their families is really important.
What about you, Kareem? I mean, you've been seeing us talk at Jen Squeeze about this massive gap between home prices and earnings and how that's playing out for a variety of groups, as Molly just described, over many years. This isn't the first report we've done in this sort of series, but we do it with an intention of trying to curate the conversation over time so that we can keep raising the level of dialogue and keep the issue sort of front of mind for citizens and decision makers alike. What's been your experience contributing to that process?
Yeah, for me, I think it's just something so important that needs to be done. And we don't really have many people doing this kind of work in Canada on these sorts of issues. When I talk to people about things like housing affordability, there's just so much misinformation out there. People think the only issue is foreign buyers. If we just ban those, everything will be okay. And there's just so much more to it. It's not that young people are lazy and buying too much coffee. And we make clear in the report, you would have to stop buying 30 coffees a day or something to save for a down payment over the course of many, many years. So I think just getting this information out there to educate people, we're not going to ever change anything if we're not on the same page about what the issue really is, what's the fundamental cause, and how we go about fixing that. So I think this is such important work to do.
Can I pick up on your observation about how a lot of the dialogue about housing will tend to look to what I often call like the easy villain? So I think like the foreign buyer or the non-resident mucking up our housing system, sort of the easy villain, because it's a person doing it over there, they're the problem. Or, you know, we often people are like, you know, if we didn't have so much money laundering through real estate, we wouldn't have such home price inflation. Or it's, you know, it's that mean-spirited NIMBY who won't let new rental developed in their neighborhood, or that mean-spirited developer who's building for the wrong kind of stuff and only in it for the profit. And whenever we have those conversations, I hear the problem's always somebody else. And I think what's complicated about where Jen Squeeze is at right now with our change-making activities is with our hard truths, we're trying to get into harder conversations with people. We're saying, you know, how might many of us be implicated? And can use my story in particular. How have the choices that I have made around home ownership and, you know, the degree to which, you know, I and others count on housing wealth in our financial security, how does that fuel a cultural addiction to high and rising home prices? And so then the problem doesn't become some other person over there. It actually becomes many of us. And I wonder, What's it been like for you having those kinds of conversations? Do you have those kinds of harder conversations with friends and family, maybe even older family members, where you resist the idea that the problem is always is this easy villain over there, but might be more complicated, and many of us be entangled in them in ways that we don't often like to think about?
Yeah, I have had some of those conversations, and it's really a pretty awkward thing, you know, to try and make clear to people. It's not that you're a bad person. It's not that maybe, you know, you bought an investment property 20 years ago. It's not like there was anything wrong with what you did. But we need to become aware of the fact that everyone kind of acting like this together, treating homes as investments rather than places to live, is a big part of what's led to the issue where we are today. So it is a very awkward thing, though, to, you know, these aren't bad people. These are our parents and grandparents, but it's just the collective behavior of everyone together has left us really in a bad place.
Yeah, I think that's part of the work that Gen Squeeze does that is really useful in this. The way of having these conversations is, as you started to set up, it's the complicity of everyone in this, and that it's the system itself that's set up for housing speculation. It's not to judge or blame individual actors, as Kareem was saying, but that's still, it's hard to recognize the systems that structure our day-to-day lives. So I find those conversations hard. I think to not be only kind of doom and gloom or negative, I also think it's kind of inspiring of late, both in conversations I'm having and just seeing more chatter about it online, is a growing interest in some of these alternative either housing models or land use approaches, people thinking about community land trusts, housing cooperatives, other kind of community-based investment opportunities. And I think that kind of gives me hope in this space where we're starting to think through what our priorities are when it comes to housing, when it comes to our communities, and how the current system may not meet those needs, and so what needs to change.
Well, I like hope. Hope is definitely something that we hold on to tightly at Generation Squeeze. And the collaborations with people like you was one of the things that continues to fuel that hope for me and the motivation. Because I do think that there still remains an opportunity for us to fix what's so dysfunctional about the housing system. I think, you know, we have this really long technical subtitle for our report that's calling on StatsCan to improve the way that it measures housing inflation. But the fact that we've seen that interest rates can have, you know, a sizable influence on the relentless increase in home prices gives me hope, because actually it wouldn't cost StatsCan really anything. It doesn't cost the government of Canada anything to improve our measurement of housing inflation going forward. So we can see that, oh, problems in its measurement in the past have had a harmful effect. Let's try and remove that harm going forward. And, you know, I'm pleased that Gen Squeeze is part of, you know, a small group of orgs like the Conference Board of Canada and the Business Council of BC, as we're bringing that message to various leaders in government and to StatsCan directly. And StatsCan, as much as we're critiquing them on this issue, I mean, they're a noble group of people doing lots of great data collection that we rely on all the time for, even in this report, it's StatsCan that gave us the earnings data. So they do great work there, and I'm hopeful they can contribute. I'm also hopeful, Molly, because we have been seeing, you know, from some of the public polling that we've been doing, that there is an appetite amongst Canadians to view housing primarily for homes first, investment second, to ask those who have benefited like me from the staggering increase in home prices to contribute slightly more to available solutions, and also to be open to taking off the sharpest edges of that homeownership tax shelter, which is inducing us to, you know, view housing as an investment strategy as opposed to first and foremost that place to call home. So those things give me hope as well, in addition to, you know, the range of ways in which community planning as a scholarly field is showcasing for us new opportunities to think differently about how we use our land and our space and build our networks and our communities and make room for everyone. Thinking about that with hope, what would you ask people listening to the podcast to do when they read the report, or at least they go on to the Gen Squeeze webpage for the report and read the summaries? What are some things you hope they'll do?
I would hope that the report helps people to recognize that this wasn't inevitable that we end up in this situation. There are certain factors that got us here. Like Molly mentioned, these are systems. They're hard to recognize. But when we do flush them out for people like this, I hope it makes clear that there's something we can do about these things. We're not powerless. There's been decisions in the past that have got us to this point, but we can do something to change them, to change things going forward, so we're not in this position for the rest of time. So I hope that people will recognize that. I hope that they won't give up hope, and that they'll try and spread the word, explain it to other people, because we need people behind us to have their support, and this will help us to motivate our political leaders to make this change that we need.
Yeah, using this as a way to get informed about what is happening with housing costs and with incomes, which can then be used as a tool to advocate. And there are great policy interventions proposed in the report. So if any of those resonate with anyone, that's a great starting point to advocate. But a simpler or personal thing that I hope this report, or just if anyone listening to this, a useful exercise might be to just recognize when you're thinking about housing or reading the news and there's things about housing, things about cost of living, you're talking about it with friends or family, to recognize when you're conceiving of housing as a commodity. And whether that's talking about housing prices going up and yeah, it's, again, not to judge or blame yourself or whoever you're talking with, but I think that's a useful way to start to recognize that it is the system. And that is the first step, I think, that's needed before we can try to dismantle it or make different ways forward.
That's interesting. So asking every one of us to do a bit of a gut check on our own assumptions, being self-aware about what our reactions are. And is that in line with, you know, further fueling the cultural addiction to high and rising home prices? Or are we having reactions that actually, if we share them with others around us, are disrupting that harmful trend? But can I just push on that a little bit further? So can you imagine the next time you're hanging out with your parents and saying, you know, I just co-wrote this report about celebrating the stall in home prices. You know, what do you think, parents? Like, you're going to celebrate with us. How do you think that conversation would go?
It'd be a good conversation. It'd be a good conversation for someone else to watch, for sure. A hard conversation. But yeah, often there is a disconnect. Like, I value my parents' values. I appreciate them enormously. And I think what they value is a fair and equitable society where everyone has access to everything they need to do fine. And so it takes those hard conversations, I think, to realize that, like, oh, but by waiting around for my assessment notice to come each year and hoping that it's gone up, like, that is contradicting your maybe inherent value of wanting a fair and just society.
What about you, Kareem? Can you imagine your parents being excited about the headline of our report?
You know, I actually had a similar conversation with my mom yesterday, and she got it. But what she asked me at the end was, what should she do about this? You know, and I think a lot of people feel that way. They understand it, but I think a lot of people just don't think anything can change. So I'm curious, what do you think, Paul? What do you think people should do? What do you hope?
Oh, goodness. You're turning the question back on me. I knew I was going to ask the question. I'm not sure I thought about the answer. Well, I think that at Gen Squeeze, if you go to our website and there's this part that says get informed. And so I think that's pretty common for a think tank. But Gen Squeeze is a think and change tank. And so we also ask people to get involved. And I think this is a part where we struggle a little bit more, in all honesty, to convince them that what we're asking is actually important. But some of the early things in our get involved list are like, spread the word. Because at bottom, systems manage to sustain themselves if they kind of have this cultural momentum that protects them. So our housing system hasn't generated a level of outrage amongst younger Canadians, I would argue, or newcomers of any age who are like, what the F is going on here? I'm working hard. I got more education. I took on more student debt to be willing to rent for longer, if not indefinitely. But there's so much precarity in rent, and there's no hope of actually getting into home ownership in some of our city centers across the country. Like, this is crazy. But we don't really have that constructive kind of rage out there on the issue as much as I might have thought. And I think that's because the cultural momentum in Canada still is around like, oh, no, like this is what home prices do. They're supposed to rise. And so I think if we could have your mom, Kareem, when she's having tea or a glass of wine or whatnot with others in her circles, just like, you know, my son wrote this really interesting report celebrating stalling home prices. That's change making right there. And then inviting their friends to share it amongst their circles. If we could get, you know, many in our parents' demographic to say, on my watch, I didn't mean it to happen, but wow, hard work is not paying off for my kids and grandchildren like I would have wanted it to. That act of affirming and spreading the word is so potentially transformative because it creates the political cover for our politicians then to respond courageously to evidence about this massive gap between earnings and average home prices. And so I would start there because I don't hear politicians, even if we have we have a new premier in BC who I think is actually on day one, he came out and he took new measures to, you know, do more to try and tackle affordability issues in BC around housing. But even that new mayor, oh goodness, Paul, that premier, Premier Eby, for goodness sakes, Premier Eby didn't say, though, he first and foremost just thinks, we don't want an economy where home prices continue to rise. And if we can't have our politicians say that, then we have to look in the mirror and ask, how are we feeding into a political milieu where that seems risky for a politician to say? And so that's what I think your mom can do, Kareem. That's what I think all our moms and dads and aunts and uncles can do, and young people generally. How can we spread the word that it's good to celebrate home prices? I think there's a moment of confusion. People aren't quite sure, and we can help fill that void because people will follow others that they trust. And, you know, we're competing well for people's trust. And I really appreciate the way in which the two of you have sort of contributed your expertise and your values to the work that we're doing. You're sharing it in your networks. And that is part and parcel of slowly but surely, incrementally changing our cultural context so that we can make this housing system work for everyone.
I'm glad I turned that around on you. You explained that much better than I would have.
I'm not so sure, but I have had a decade plus now to think about what is the theory of change driving Gen Squeeze and the spreading the word. You know, I think people think, oh, clicktivism, like just one more thing online doesn't matter. But it absolutely is the case that spreading the word or joining groups like Generation Squeeze or the Ontario Not-for-Profit Housing Association or the BC Nonprofit Housing Association or Cooperative Housing Federation, like when you join those organizations and you make them more influential because their power grows with the size of their network, that matters in the world of politics. So there are ways that we can, when we're time constrained, contribute to rejuvenating democracy. And I see that, you know, the clock is clicking ahead of me right now. So I'm going to use that as a moment to say, all right, let's transition to saying thank you, thank you, thank you, Molly and Kareem, both for joining us on the podcast, but even more so for all the work that you put into creating the content for this latest housing report in our Straddling the Gap series at Gen Squeeze. I'm proud of it. I'm proud of the way that it's going to, I believe, attract a ton of media attention and further fuel good, concrete, hard conversations amongst our friends, family, and our political leaders. You know, one way that we're using this report is to both attract media attention, but also we will distribute a summary of the report to every elected official provincially and federally in this country. And if they do nothing other than see the headline and the subheadline, they will be prodded and cajoled to say, wow, look at, there are groups out there celebrating stalling home prices, and they have concerns that this massive gap between home prices and earnings has been fueled by problems at Statistics Canada. Every single elected leader in this country, provincially and federally, will have that come across their desk as a result of this report. So I'm really, really appreciative of the way that the two of you have made that possible for us as an organization and as a country to continue to prod and push the dialogue in this direction. So thanks so much for joining us today on Hard Truths. You know, the work to fix our broken generational system is important, and it's hard, and your volunteering is making it a bit of an easier path for us all. And I hope our listeners are going to join us to make Canada work for all generations. Follow the advice we were just giving to Kareem's mom. And, you know, share this episode in your networks
and more generally encourage people to find our Hard Truths podcast wherever they get their podcast material. And do join up at our website, gensqueeze.ca, because as I emphasized in my answer to Kareem, our power as a community to fix the housing system, to fix the childcare system, to fix the healthcare system, to make climate policy better and let us live in a planet that doesn't grow too hot. It all grows with the power of our network, and each and every one joining our network makes us that much more powerful. Onwards.